So what I'll do is to talk briefly by highlighting some of the main themes in that paper that you've read, which I think was called What Children Learn from Testimony, but an alternate title is Are Children Stubborn Autodidacts? And in some sense, for those of you who might be interested, you can think of this as a as an introduction to the course that I'll be teaching in the spring, which has that title. So, first of all, I'll briefly mention some recent thinking about the role of testimony that comes from outside of psychology. Then I'll turn to look back at some work in cognitive development which highlights the role of testimony, even though the investigators didn't particularly think of their doing that. And then here I'll talk a bit about ways in which, once you allow that children are alert to testimony, well, that probably expands the envelope of potential topics that you might want to study as far as children's cognitive development is concerned. So, for example, children's religious beliefs, that's been something of a backwater of study in cognitive development. I actually think it's rather interesting. And I'll tell you a little bit about some research that we've been doing in that direction and some studies that we have in mind. So there's a brief overview. So let's turn then to take a look at some recent thinking about the role of testimony. And I want to mention a couple of books, in one in epistemology, one in the history of science, and then, as you'll see, and as I've mentioned, I'm going to talk later about cognitive development. So, in the early 90s, there was a book published by Cody, an Australian philosopher, who really took this topic of testimony, gave it a book-length treatment, and to some extent put it on the map. Now, by testimony, he simply meant the following. There are all sorts of things that you and I can't observe for ourselves. We can't really observe the past. Most of history is conveyed to us by virtue of communication with other people. A great deal of information, even about the present, such as where we are at the moment, or where we might be at the moment, is conveyed to us by other people. So he offers a philosophical analysis of, first of all, the pervasiveness of testimony in our everyday lives, as I'll illustrate a little bit more in a moment, and also raises a very traditional question in philosophy about the extent to which we should or should not trust testimony. And up to a point, it's fair to say, I think testimony has a bad press, or has had a bad press within epistemology, largely due to David Hume, who associated his arguments against believing in miracles with our reliance on information about miracles on testimony. So in some sense, a mistrust of the existence of miracles and a mistrust of reliance on testimony became yoked in people's minds. So that's one book. Another book is to some extent also drawn from philosophy, but this is more history and philosophy of science, and it's a book about the way in which communities work within science. So, just to say a little bit more about Cody and about Chapin. He basically tries to alert us to the fact that there's a tremendous amount of information which we can't check for ourselves. And in standard epistemological approaches to validity and trustworthiness, the notion of checking for yourself has been central. Cody points out the dilemma that there's only a tiny sample of beliefs that we have that we could check for ourselves. And he gives a kind of mini parable to illustrate his point. So, my first morning in Amsterdam, I wake uncertain of the time and I ring the hotel clerk to discover the hour, accepting the testimony of his voice. And I read a paperback history book which contains all manner of factual claims that neither I nor the writer can support by personal observation or memory or by deduction from either. I reflect that on arriving at a strange city a day or so earlier, I had only the aircrew's word that this was Amsterdam. And in some sense, I think, if you think about it a moment, you'll recognize that we're all very often in that position. Once we move beyond, as it were, the desk in front of ourselves and go a little bit further afield in space or in time, we navigate by virtue of other people's testimony. Chapin's analysis is especially focused on the Royal Society in 17th century England, and he points out that these members of the Royal Society, whose motto actually was the motto was on no man's word, and paradoxically their trust on the words of other people is amply exemplified by their procedures and sociometry, as he argues. They formed a kind of exclusive club in which there was indeed mutual trust, and anyone, so to speak, who was a member of that inner circle and misled his fellow scientists was not, as it were, literally excommunicated, but his reputation fell like a stone. And he points out that this kind of sociometric formation continues to function in everyday science, and members of scientific communities meet one another, exchange information about their latest experiments. And even if you narrow it down and you look at a particular paper, a single paper in science or nature, very often those single papers are multi-authored, and the authors themselves are relying on one another's testimony with respect to different sections of the paper. So science itself is deeply embedded in this trust in other people's testimony. And of course, part of one's navigation in science depends in part on figuring out the nature of these groups and who to some extent is more reliable when it comes to analyzing a particular new phenomenon than another. And people have all sorts of intuitions and historical information that they bring to bear in making those judgments. Well, if that's true of adults navigating in their everyday life and scientists in their professional life, it's conceivable that children are also in the same boat. They too are likely to be swimming in this ocean of testimony. And more generally, their dependence is likely to cover claims about the everyday world, and more scientific claims as well. If anything, you could argue, I suppose, in principle, that children might be even more dependent than adults. On the other hand, if you look back at developmental theory, I don't think it acknowledges this human fact. I think it tends to present the child as what I have dubbed as a stubborn autodidact. That's true of classic Piagetian theory, and I think it's also true of more recent versions of Piagetian theory, which present the child as an intuitive scientist with various mini theories about different bits of the world that the child is constructing and reconstructing. So just to, in some sense, I hope I don't have to go into this. I think I am alluding to things that you will have already touched on in this course. But just to say, make a few remarks then. Piaget's important claim was that the infant who's building a conception of objects, or the preschooler who's building a conception of quantity, is doing so primarily on the basis of his or her own active observation, experimentation, and reconstruction. There's no essential role in Piaget's theory which is assigned to other people's testimony. If anything, of course, Piaget emphasizes the fact that children's errors are, say, in the conservation problem or in searching for hidden objects, are rather surprising from the point of view of adult ideas. So an adult would claim that the two glasses of water, despite their difference in shape, hold equal quantities, and the child does not. Now, the child as scientist approach, in many ways, I think, is Piagetian. The main difference between those two approaches is that latterly, cognitive development mentalists have emphasized the possibility that, first of all, the child's concepts in one domain, let's say physics, are distinct from and unrelated to the child's concepts in another domain, let's say biology or psychology. So the child is pursuing concurrently multiple domains. So there's no pan-domain principles, which is different from the standard Piagetian approach, which typically assumed that there was some kind of rather general logic at each stage of development. I suppose it's also true to say that more recent child as scientist approaches have been a bit more generous than Piaget wanted to be about the native endowment of the child. So in other words, they've been tempted to argue, and I gather you've been doing some work on modularity, they've been tempted to argue that the baby comes equipped with certain intuitive assumptions or preferences or biases which get the child started in particular domains, whether it's the domain of inanimate physical objects or the domain of persons. So a disagreement with Piaget there about just how long a haul confronts the child in these various domains, but nevertheless there's no real insistence in these modern neo-Piagetian theories that the child looks over his or her shoulder and is very dependent upon other people's testimony for interpreting the phenomena that he or she constructs. I it's also true, I think, that if you look at this child as scientist approach, there's a certain silence which is informative. If you really believed that children's opportunities to benefit from other people's testimony were very consequential and important, you would, it seems to me, anticipate that the nature of cognitive development pre-verbally, in the first couple of years, was going to be pretty different from the nature of cognitive development thereafter, when the child can begin to expand his or her universe by virtue of talking to other people. But if you look at people like Alison Gopnik, and I would be tempted to say Susan Carey, although when I've discussed this with her, I think she's more inclined to resist. But certainly Alison Gopnik and Andrew Meltzoff in their book, The Scientist in the Crib, exactly. I think you'll see there that this child as scientist position is espoused equally emphatically for the pre-verbal infant as for the verbal child.
Well, can we have discussion in the middle, or do you want to wait till later?
Go ahead.
There's a growing movement over the last 20 years about babies, not these people, but other people, about babies picking up lots of information from their parents. For example, facial expressions, using facial expressions as testimony, in a sense, to give evaluation or meaning to particular events.
Yeah. I think that's right, and even somebody as radical as Alison Gopnik would acknowledge that the baby comes attuned to other people, but I don't think I'm wrong in claiming that when you look at the thrust of that book...
Well, I agree with you about that.
Okay.
What you're saying is it's
discontinuity.
Right? Babies are, in fact, using information from adults.
Oh, I see what you mean. I see what you mean. Yeah. Although, of course, that's affective information.
Right. And, so, are you equating this one with verbal information?
I think you can. This is the beginning of a long discussion. But so, let me just give a brief answer.
Okay.
It seems to me that, as I was driving to work today, there was an interesting discussion about a legal debate regarding burning crosses and the extent to which they could be construed as speech. Well, without getting into that somewhat delicate and controversial case, it does seem to me that there are all sorts of actions which can reasonably be construed as propositional. They, as it were, assert such and such a belief. Now, whether I would go so far as to say that a facial expression is effectively propositional in that sense, I'm not sure. I think a more cautious interpretation would be that it's best construed as a kind of warning signal. But exactly at what point the baby becomes, as it were, open to testimony, and exactly what kind of medium or media feed into that is an interesting debate. Yeah.
Is
what a conflict?
Like the concept that children will learn from testimony.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's true, of course, that some of Piaget's classic work was did indeed concentrate on infants, but I mean Piaget did research all the way from infancy through to late adolescence, and in no sense is his work predominantly identified with the infancy period. Far from it. It's of a piece, and it extends, as I say, from, you know, throughout the long course of childhood.
Indeed, much of it dealt with science, where testimony would seem to be essential.
If anything, Piaget would have argued that kids tend to ignore testimony that's inconsistent with their own understanding, and he critiqued verbal efforts to get kids to get conservation responses as being called pseudo-conservation, and the claim was not robust. So here's a different position from the one that Paul was arguing.
I mean, just one other point, which is that occasionally Piaget claimed you could find what seemed to be a sophisticated answer on the part of the child, but he dismissed it on the grounds that it was mere verbalism. In other words, he said, oh, this child has just picked something up from an adult, and if you probe a bit more, it falls apart. The child doesn't genuinely understand. And I don't want to knock that position. That may well be applicable in certain areas, and there's quite a lot of debate within science education about the extent to which a mere verbal understanding is indeed attained sometimes in the classroom. Any more? No? Okay, so let me press on. Okay, so I'm just making this point then that proponents of this child as scientist tend to move, as it were, without any marking, seamlessly between the pre-verbal infant and the older child. They don't really make a distinction. Well, this is a quotation from Peter Lipton, a philosopher of science, who wrote a very nice review of the two books that I mentioned earlier, and in fact drew my attention to them. And at the beginning of his review, he in some sense echoes this point that Cody made, and says that there are all sorts of mundane beliefs that you and I share that depend on testimony. For example, that the earth is round, or that you think with your brain. And then one that really is intriguing, as soon as you think about it, even quite personal facts, such as your birthday or the identity of your biological parents. So we're getting, as it were, fairly close to home here. And then he goes on to talk about the way in which the literature in epistemology doesn't exactly sparkle with the word testimony. It's all to do with truth and belief and validity and so forth, and testimony doesn't have much of a look in. Okay. Well, that set me thinking, that sentence there, and it occurred to me that we could begin to ask some questions about some of those beliefs, how children acquire them, and the extent to which they do rely on testimony. So we could look in a bit more detail at the way that children learn facts about the shape of the earth, about the relationship between thinking and the brain, and then one that's not on his list, but it's an interesting one to look at, the origin of species. So let me just briefly run through the evidence there. This is some recent work by Butterworth and colleagues. And amongst, I'm giving you a very synoptic view of what they did. They asked many questions of the children and looked for coherence among the children's answers. Here's just one question. If you walked for many days in a straight line, would you fall off the edge of the world? And as you can see, even among young children, the answer is predominantly no, but by the age of 8 or 9, the answer is very definitely no. Very few children believe that you will fall off the edge of the world. More generally, if you ask them about the shape of the earth, and whether you come back to the place where you started off, if you're a bird and you keep on flying, children are building up during this period a pretty emphatic and consistent notion of the earth as being round. Here's some work by Carl Johnson. He was interested in children's understanding of the relationship between the brain and the mind. So he asked them, on the one hand, questions about the effects of a transplant on various cognitive processes, and then, as a control question, the effect of various transplants on cognitive processes. Actually, I was a bit disconcerted in reading the Gazette, the Harvard Gazette, the other day, where indeed there was an article about some of the cognitive deficits that do arise from heart transplants. But let's for the moment assume that they're less dramatic than the changes that might accrue from a brain transplant. Okay. Well, basically, the children, all, even at 6 years of age, made claims about the effect of a brain transplant on your ability to engage in these cognitive processes, but assume that they would be unaffected by a heart transplant.
Is that a U-shape because they can read the Gazette?
Yes, it's interesting. They may well be alert to some of the secondary effects of yeah.
It would be nice to ask Aristotle something.
Why Aristotle in particular? Oh, right. So maybe it would have been inverted in his case. Right. Okay, following this up, Carl Johnson came up with this story which I always like. It's got that very child-friendly quality to it. The child was then invited, so this is to some extent a somewhat more dramatic question. Now we're going to pretend something happens to Garby. We'll pretend that we take your brain out of your head and put it inside Garby's head, and suppose we ask this pig, with your brain, who are you, what would he say? So now we're moving beyond the question of brain and mind, I guess, to the question of personal identity. And the children, these 5 and 6 year olds, are not convinced that this pig with the child's brain, they think that pig would continue to think of itself as being a pig. By 7 years of age, though, the majority are recognizing the implications, or assuming the implications, of such a brain transplant for personal identity. So, now let's look at some very intriguing work by Margaret Evans. She was interested in children's understanding of a particular bit of Darwinian theory, namely the origin of species, and she got at this by asking children about the origins of a familiar species, such as a dinosaur, and she coded children's answers into 3 different categories: spontaneous, creation, or evolution. Here are the data from children growing up in a non-fundamentalist community. By non-fundamentalist, she means, I think, a Midwestern town with a college community, and, as it were, an average American level of church attendance. Well, as you can see in this non-fundamentalist community, evolutionary answers are climbing between 6 years in adulthood, although creationism is still doing pretty well, even in this community and even among adults. But in some sense, this embryonic evolutionary thinking already attests to the role of testimony, it seems to me, from a very early age. Now we can get a better sense of the role of testimony by taking a look at the fundamentalist community with which she contrasted this one, where you can see that evolutionary thinking makes very little headway and creationism is much more dominant. Now you might be tempted to say that creationism is in some sense a default option for young children, it's their unreflective presupposition, but that's not quite right. If you look at the difference between these two graphs, even among the 6-year-olds in the non-fundamentalist community, you're seeing a different pattern. So I'm assuming that this must be due to the overall nature of the information that I don't suppose that the fossil record that children can observe in the fundamentalist community and the non-fundamentalist community is sufficiently different to lead children in different directions. This is due to the information they're being provided with. So, very briefly then, it looks as if these children who are in elementary school and middle school are learning from testimony about the shape of the earth, the relationship between thinking and the brain, and the origin of species. Now let's try and conceptualize this a bit more. We could say, I suppose, that yes, children rely on other people's testimony, but what actually happens is that other people simply extend the range of phenomena that children can observe. So other people serve as a kind of microscope or telescope or time machine. So children haven't really shifted their epistemological stance, the one that they were confined to or made use of in that pre-verbal period when for the most part they relied on the testimony of their senses. Now all that's happened really is that they just have got lots more perceptual data. It's just gained by proxy. That would be one interpretation of what's going on here. And if you look at Gopnik, Meltzoff and Kuhl, that's roughly the interpretation, it seems to me, that they come up with. I'll just give you a moment to read that. Okay, I want to also emphasize this final point. Together, the children and the grown-ups and other children who take care of them form a kind of system for getting at the truth. So, you could argue that, yes, indeed, we've neglected the role of testimony, but all that testimony does is make children more efficient truth seekers. Now, I think there are some fundamental problems with this view, and I'm going to identify a couple of them. One is intercommunity variation, and the second is whether testimony can be narrowly construed as mere empirical report. I don't think it can be. So let's focus first of all on the intercommunity variation. And this is most readily illustrated by thinking a bit about children's conclusions about evolution. Well, we've just seen that they vary depending upon the community that the children are growing up in. And we've acknowledged that no doubt this is due to the fact that the communities differ in the testimony that the children are offered. But it would be a pretty bizarre claim to say, well, one of those communities just has fewer data around, and the other community has somehow or other got some more data. So the only difference is one of amplification. Much more plausible is that these claims are just radically different. It's not a question of there being some quantitative difference in the amount of observational data that are respectively at their disposal. And of course, you and I might be tempted to say that the claims made by one community are indeed more defensible than the claims made by another community. And this is just one illustration of that issue. So that's one point. Now, is testimony merely empirical report? Well, I'm already hinting that it's not, but let me try to drive that point home more emphatically by telling you briefly about some research that I did with Marta Gimenez on children's understanding of God. So we gave the children a double interview. One was about the extent to which it's possible to know things, and the other was about the extent to which it's possible to live forever. And in each case, the children were questioned about two different people or beings, one being their friend and the other being God. So just to give you a feel for this, at one point we asked the children, let's pretend we gave this present to, we might say, your best friend, and we asked him to tell us what is inside the box without taking the paper off. Would your best friend know for sure what's in the box, or would he have to guess? In another section of the interview, the child might be told, let's pretend we gave this present to God, and we asked him to tell us what is inside the box. Would God know for sure, and so forth. And then children were invited to justify their answer. Here's a question from the immortality interview. What's going to happen to your best friend next year, or what's going to happen to God next year, and so forth. Well, just jumping to the results, we tested 3 and 5 year olds, and the important thing to notice is that, as you might expect, no doubt you've done some work on theory of mind, between the ages of 3 and 4, children gain a good deal of insight into so-called perceptual constraints on belief. So in talking about their friend, they say, no, he wouldn't know what's inside the box because he can't see inside. Now, if we look at God, on the other hand, although God and best friend are not differentiated at 4 years, by the age of five, God is beginning to not be subject to those constraints. So children differentiate God from their best friend. And that's borne out also when we ask the children to justify their replies. So children in, sorry, let me just clarify. These are, I'm, in order to be quick, I'm giving you the data for the justifications. So this is the frequency with which children refer to perceptual constraints like you can't see through the paper, or he couldn't see through the paper, or it's all covered up. Common for best friend, and declining by the age of five for God. So what's happening with respect to God? Well, they're invoking magical powers. God is special, they'll say, or God can see through things, or God will know it already. Much the same pattern with the life cycle references. So as children are interviewed about their friend, they talk increasingly with age about change over time, and ultimately about they talk about the finite nature of the life cycle. It has a beginning, you grow older and you die. Those references are much less frequent for God. On the other hand, references to magical powers, not very frequent, but beginning to appear around 4 and 5 years of age. So again, children talk about God's special capacities or special abilities. So, as far as mortals are concerned, children are talking about the constraints of perceptual access and the constraints of biology. And as far as God is concerned, they're denying these constraints. Now, presumably, children can scarcely have arrived at these conclusions on the strength of any kind of empirical investigation. They're relying on testimony, presumably, the testimony of whatever religion it is that they're participating in. And I might say that when we did these studies, we did them in Madrid, and we deliberately questioned children who were attending a convent-based school as compared to other children who were tested in a secular school. And somewhat to our surprise, the children in both types of school showed us a similar developmental pattern. So we can't attribute this increasing knowledge of the special nature of God to the kind of dedicated religious instruction that children are getting in schools. It's more pervasive than that. Children, even those going to so-called secular schools, are exposed to it in ways that we don't fully understand at the moment. And they seem to be relatively quick at picking it up, and they seem to be relatively, what can we say, non-anthropomorphic about God, because otherwise, if they were anthropomorphic, they would presumably, as they get to know these biological constraints and these psychological constraints, they would insist that God was subject to them too. So, more generally, this clearly shows, I think, that the nature of the information that's being given to children in testimony can't be conceived of as narrowly empirical. Children are being offered claims that go well beyond anything that's empirical. Yeah?
Is it difficult to have an innate idea of God? In that case, this would be offered a definition which we would call God's testimony to explain.
Yes. It's conceivable, And some people certainly want to argue that there are some, as it were, natural predispositions on the part of young children that make them amenable to thinking about, conceptualizing God. On the other hand, if you looked at our developmental data, this is the one where it's most evident, the special nature of God is increasingly apparent to these older children. It doesn't. Well, you can play it both ways, of course. You can say, of course, these three-year-olds don't really realize that perceptual constraints exist on anybody. So up to a point, you could argue, I suppose, that God concepts capitalize on some default assumption, some naive assumptions which children arrive at very early on in thinking about any kind of agent. And then, I mean, if anything, you could say, I suppose turning the whole thing on its head, you could say, what's really problematic for children is not learning about God, but learning about people. Yeah. So there is some way, there's a way in which you could push that argument, I think. Yeah.
How is learning
I agree with you, of course. Presumably the vast majority of children in pre-Copernicus assumed indeed that the earth was flat. So
It's a socially agreed upon truth.
Yes.
So that it's as much
a social consensus as an empirical report. Yes. Yes.
Actually, today we are living in a world in which there are millions of communities inventing the first that are.
Yes.
I am wondering if the testimony or the belief that incorporated in our today's culture. I mean, maybe it's just a theological issue to consider wrong instead of considering it left. Actually, there is no representation of a left planet.
Yes. I agree with you, children these days do find that representation all over the place. But I would underline the fact that it's not a representation which is self-evident in its significance. It's a picture of a sphere, and children have to rely on other people's testimony to know what that means. They have to rely on other people's testimony to tell them that this represents the earth on which you live. So even with the as it were, visualization aid which such a representation offers them, they're still nevertheless highly dependent upon other people's testimony for inserting that into some kind of conceptual system.
The question is, should we start from the perception of a flat planet, or should we start from this perception taken by media of a sphere?
Yes. Well, I suppose you're right that in some sense, indeed, there's quite a lot of work in developmental psychology by people like Wozniadu and Brewer who investigated this issue, in which their presupposition was that the primordial perceptual data available to the child was of the horizon, was of a flat earth. Now, you're making an alternative suggestion, which is that no, children also have some relatively widespread and easily accessible data which would suggest to them a sphere. But I do think in the second case, I would still insist that it only comes to be relevant by virtue of its being testified as relevant. Yep.
Yeah.
evolution from the earth, the evolution of the relationship between mind and spirit.
Right, yeah. Well, I'm not trying to insist that there's anything terribly surprising about these data. If you find them immediately congenial, that's fine with me. But I'm trying to say that they don't really fit into standard approaches that we have at the moment of cognitive development. Certainly agree with that. And so going back to your initial point, I think you're absolutely right to say that ultimately there's no fundamental conflict between maintaining a belief in constructivism on the one hand and acknowledging the role of testimony on the other. But I think if you look at contemporary developmental psychology and to some extent science education, such a conflict is implied on the grounds that, if anything, people, it's emphasized, adopt their own intuitive theories, primarily ignoring scientific testimony. Then they confront, either in the classroom or in the laboratory or in textbooks, information which is difficult to assimilate into those pre-existing frameworks. And so to that extent you end up with the notion, as I was trying to elaborate in the case of Wozniak, Du and Brewer, with the notion that on the one hand there's the sort of standard Piagetian style constructivist approach, and then on the other hand the children get some more, quotes, accurate representations and testimony, and the two are in conflict with one another. Now, it needn't be that way, but that's the way it seems to me that contemporary cognitive theory lies. But, as I say, to repeat my earlier point, I think you are absolutely right that if we had an enlarged notion of what the available information is to the child, it wouldn't just be, as it were, the hands-on personal observation, it would be a panoply of data. We could still, nevertheless, insist that a constructivist approach to that is the best way to think about it.
I'm wondering if you do a different kind of cognitive insurance for the child. Like something like Superman.
Yes.
All kids have a fairly baseline interaction as opposed to something that is a function of what kind of ability they have. How would they behave asking, could Superman see through those thoughts?
Yeah. I'm tempted to say they'd be pretty good at Superman too.
Right, but I would guess that that would be a function of what if they were in a fundamentally non-conscious. It seems like that would be a link up to instead of what is your question. You kind of understand what I'm saying?
No, not yet.
Well, I'm wondering if it's something unique to God as an omnipotent creature, or is it that something about omnipotence that kids are getting, or is it just God? So if you had Superman or another sort of superhero that has superpowers and is all-knowing in that way, but isn't a function of religion, would they behave as God?
Well, my temptation is to say, and I mean, cognitive anthropologists of religion have said it before me, that many of these concepts of the supernatural or metaphysical do turn on some kind of deletion of a constraint which we assume to be in place for ordinary mortals. So we'll find various metaphysical creatures, some of whom might be in some sense more like Superman. And of course, we could even, as you're pointing out, I think we can step outside of the religious domain and we can find these constructions in the world of fiction as well. But I'm not sure whether that in any sense is a problem.
What is the problem? I'm saying, is it God that they're figuring out, or is it omniscience?
I see. I would say it's probably a conjunction of both. In other words, I'm not sure, but we would need more questions, but I'm assuming that we could ask them some questions about omnipotence, which they probably wouldn't be prepared to attribute to God. In other words, they end up with a relatively definite representation of God's powers that owes something to the theology within which they're growing up. But it's parasitic upon this larger cognitive ability, which is the ability to think about the suppression of secular or mortal powers. Yeah. But there may be another representation which would be somewhat different, which they would equally be well capable of were they growing up in that particular community. Yeah, so I don't, in that sense, you know, I'm not particularly hung up on God, if I may put it that way. Yeah.
I'm trying to sort out two different factors, the role of testimony and something that you could pretty argue. Well, argue without justification is something that is not an empirical piece of information that is God, that might be tricky as far as where we get to the notion of God and the constraints that sort of later.
Excuse me, could somebody shut the door because I can't hear what you are saying for what they're saying?
Well, he might have something to
Fine, but one at a time.
Okay, the question again is
Well, is it different that they ask the question of testimony about things that you could argue really don't have an empirical foundation, such as God, that I'm sure we could get some arguments about it, but for the most part, let's say the idea of God is very much different from the idea of a flat ground and apparent energy.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
In some respects, it seems like it's not terribly difficult to argue the role of testimony in getting everything on things that don't really have an empirical foundation. I'm sure it goes beyond that, but I guess the action in a way seems to be what's the relationship of testimony in things that do have that empirical foundation. And I guess the data that we've looked at that, I would say, the evolution or the species, none of us have that. And I know that you're not arguing that as well, but it does seem to be different if you talk about this sort of broader framework, developmental theories on something that is essentially not here.
I don't think I fully assimilating the question at the present. Let me just respond a little bit, and then you'll tell me if I'm going wrong. Put it this way: the position we could arrive at following this is to say there are certain things that the children can observe for themselves, and probably do indeed arrive at conclusions about for themselves. Let's say naive physics. There are other things that children, as it happens, can't make observations about, and so they rely on other people's testimony, such as the shape of the earth, or the relationship between the brain and cognitive processes. There are other things, still other things, which they can't make empirical observations about, and nor can anybody else, such as these metaphysical claims. Now, in some sense, we're imagining, as it were, a small circle, a slightly bigger circle, and a still bigger circle. If one thinks about it like that, then there are some very interesting questions to ask about whether, in some sense, once the child has stepped out of the first circle, how the epistemological landscape appears. Does it suddenly look different, less secure? What's the relationship between the second circle and the third circle? Now, those are the questions I'm going to come to in a moment, but maybe you had something different in mind.
I think that's a good point. We'll see.
How things pan out? Okay. Oh, right. Hi. Sure.
My question is twofold. You mentioned Susan Carey, and she was in class talked about conceptual change. It seems to me she accounts for the role of testimony when the scientific belief is presented to a child. And she's interested in how actually whether a constructive theory can be applied to that cognitive change in the child's thinking. So it seems to me that she does account for testimony. Great. In the transition from naive biology to scientific biology. But I think what's also interesting to account for is when children move away from testimony, things would go like the opposite loop. And I think about all these graffiti we've seen in Parks Square, now Santa is real. And children are presented with that testimony that Santa is real when they're young. And it would be interesting to see how do they reject that testimony in the construction of that new world.
Yes.
And they seem to be to do it early on as they're looking for the
universe. Yeah. I mean, just as far as Sue Carey is concerned, I mean, she, I agree, would in some sense make a point similar to the one that you made. I think she would say, look, surely with respect to biological concepts, children have to assimilate all sorts of information via testimony, but that doesn't in any sense finesse or negate the question that she wants to pose, which is how conceptual change is possible. And I think she's right about that, but I would also insist that even she, Susan, is to some extent still operating with a post-Piagetian agenda, since she's focusing ultimately on, as it were, the non-metaphysical. She doesn't ever branch out beyond the world of science. And it seems to me, on the other hand, that children's epistemological lives move all over the place. And they do have to deal with a lot of different issues, some of which, as it were, belong to circle one, some to circle two, and some to circle three, to echo the terminology I just used. So to that extent, I would say I'm trying to push beyond the agenda that Sue Carey wants to emphasize. As far as children's eventual skepticism about Santa Claus is concerned, yes, I mean, I think that's a very interesting issue, and of course skepticism about God or the afterlife is also an interesting issue as well.
What are the criteria that children use in cases, like epistemological cases, where they don't have personal observation?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It makes me wonder about the role of developing capacity for abstraction as a part of abstract thinking, as a part of being able to say, okay, I can't understand how this happened, but I see this and this and this, and they don't tie together to answer that, but they tie together to give me some clues to that that makes me ask a different question to hear something else in terms of testimony. And I think in some ways organized religion, although I don't think it's particularly well now, I think there's a reason why confirmation and bar mitzvahs and things are at 12 and 13, because it's a time when, leading up to that time, kids have been relying on testimony for the things that they, you know, can't see in the real world. But at 12 or 13, as they're able to think more abstractly about what they do see in the real world and what they can see and how those things fit together, the church has these things in place to help, supposedly, to help them think about, all right, now that I can think about these things for myself in a different way, how do I now reconstruct my own sense of my existence in this greater whole? So to me, it's that whole idea of where the capacity for abstraction fits in with the role of testimony.
So going back to this question, I hinted at a moment ago about how children think of this epistemological landscape. You would anticipate that there might be some marked changes or differentiations that start to emerge in early adolescence. Yeah.
How testimony fits with other kinds of input
. Okay, I'm going to press on. I'm getting there, and then I'll stop, and we'll talk some more. Okay, I just want to tell you something a bit about some research that we're doing at the moment, which is very briefly touched on at the end of the chapter you read, and it raises the following issue, which flows from what we've been talking about, which is what kind of ontological commitments do young children make? And you could say, well, they might be terribly conservative. They might be especially inclined to believe in things that they can observe for themselves. Alternatively, you could say maybe they are a bit more venturesome, particularly if indeed they are trusting of testimony, and so they're inclined to believe in and accept as real things like germs, hormones, genes, and so forth. So to explore this issue, we have been contrasting two different theorists, so to speak, or two different ideal children. This stubborn autodidact, whom I already mentioned, or what I've dubbed, on the other hand, the trusting disciple. And if you just look down the left and right hand columns, you can see the difference between these two. The stubborn autodidact believes in entities that he can observe for himself, and is much more nervous about any belief in germs and vitamins, and essentially is inclined to think that having a concept is tantamount to being able to identify instances of it, knowing what things look like that fall under that concept. Now, the trusting disciple, on the other hand, is a bit different. Not a bit different, is plainly different. That trusting disciple trusts other people. And if anything, and this is an interesting point which one of these days I hope to develop, if anything, the child is using their theory of mind to work out their ontology. They're saying, how can I explain other people's actions and statements? Well, they'll make sense if I take it for true that such and such things exist. So if they see, I mean, let me suppress that example. I'll come to that in a moment. So they would believe equally in germs and cats, and they would be inclined to admit that they wouldn't need to know what something looked like. They wouldn't even necessarily be able to identify a single instance of a concept to, in some, to some measure, have that concept. So we've been asking children about three types of entity: some pretty ordinary observable entities, rabbits and so forth, some unobservable entities such as germs, and in order to make sure we got some negative responses, some no's in our children's replies, we asked them about things like flying pigs. So here's the first question. Are there really, and in the slot would go something like, rabbits in the world, or are there really germs in the world, or are there really flying pigs in the world? And the key point to notice is that, well, first of all, children are fairly comfortable saying that certain things don't exist, but strikingly, they are just as credulous toward germs as they are toward rabbits. So they're inclined to believe in something they cannot see. They don't have any more doubt about it. Now, you could say, well, in some sense, they're, when pressed, acknowledging that germs exist, but maybe they don't really, they're not so convinced about germs. They are less confident. Well, we try to get at that by asking the children, okay, you said that there really are germs. Are you very sure or a little bit sure? So we try to gauge their degree of confidence. Or equally, if they said, no, there's no red elephants, we would say, well, are you sure about that? Or are you just a little bit sure? Well, there are the responses. Children are as confident, this is the key point, children are as confident here about their belief in germs as they are confident of their belief in rabbits. Finally, we ask them, do you know what rabbits, germs look like? And as you can see, not surprisingly, they do claim to know what rabbits and cats and so forth look like. They're much less likely to claim that they know what germs look like. So here then we've got pretty strong evidence that children's ontology is already reaching out to embrace these non-observable entities. Now that raises some interesting questions which we want to explore in the future, and it goes back to, as it were, circle 2 and circle 3, which I mentioned a moment ago. We haven't yet asked children about angels or witches or God, but in some sense you could argue, depending upon the community that the child is growing up in, that they're going to fall roughly in this category. They're going to be as real for the child as are germs and vitamins. In some sense, the presupposition that God exists makes as much sense of adult discourse as the presupposition that germs exist makes sense of their warnings about not to touch that, not to drink that, and so forth. More generally, you could argue then that children end up listening to adults' discourse, and to the extent that certain emphases are presupposed, taken for granted, not really held up as things you should believe in, but just talked about in relatively uneventful ways as if they existed, then you will end up believing in them. So the implication of that claim would be that probably we might find somewhat different belief or attitudes towards, say, God or angels or the devil, essentially depending upon the discourse that surrounds those entities. We could imagine a child growing up in a fundamentalist community for whom all those beings are as real as germs. We could also imagine children growing up in a more secular community where talk about those beings is much more in inverted commas and is certainly not routine, in which case the child would perhaps be more equivocal. We haven't done the experiment yet, so I can't tell you the answer. But it's a way of making sense of the fact that, so far as we know at least, young children do believe in Santa Claus and do believe in God. Now let me just finally, I'm not going to answer your question, because I'm just going to finish off, okay? But come back to it. Let's just run through some conclusions and I'll mention another study that we're about to run. So, I've argued that children don't rely on, by any means, completely on first-hand observation. They incorporate lots of different information. They incorporate information that violates their mundane folk theories. That's most evident when they're talking about God. And there's some interesting questions to ask there, because a lot of the work in science education suggests that children have great difficulty in incorporating scientific information which violates their intuitive theories. As far as God is concerned, God is in some sense a violation of their intuitive theory of ordinary human beings, and yet they seem to assimilate that information relatively easily. I said that children's basic ontology, well, not just their beliefs, their way in which they carve up the world into what's real, that depends on other people's testimony. And I've also implied in the end then that it's far too simple to claim that children and grown-ups form, to echo Gopnik and her colleagues, a kind of system for getting at the truth. At the very least, the truth has to be defined much more widely than the kind of scientific truth that I think Gopnik and colleagues have in mind. Now, children, clearly having got this far, I think we've already stumbled across the fact that children are essentially then grappling with different types of testimony. And this is something that I want to look at but haven't really yet pinned down. Some testimony is aimed at matters of fact, and some is aimed at matters of faith. An important question is how children begin to differentiate the types of testimony that they are exposed to. And I think this goes back to your question about the extent to which various religious institutions recognize, as it were, this increasingly differentiated landscape that children are identifying. Now let's just focus on a question, an issue where this comes to a head, so to speak. So this is some research that we're about to start. So according to standard accounts of children's intuitive biology, and you will have no doubt heard about this from Sue Carey, they gradually understand the terminal nature of death. So by that, so the theory states, by the age of 8 or 9 or 10, we can move the age up and down a little bit, children realize there's a biological machine, and they realize that it comes to a halt, and that switches off all physiological and neural and psychological processes. It's the end of the line. On the other hand, most children are going to be exposed to some metaphysical claims about the afterlife. So here, the situation is in some sense more fraught, it seems to me, than the one we've looked at before. With respect to the research that we did on God, the child could sort of say, well, there's ordinary people on the one hand, and people make various claims, or there are certain principles that apply to ordinary mortals, and then there's God as well, and there are other principles that apply there. But with respect to the nature of death, we're talking about the very same event being construed in two radically different ways that ultimately don't fit together terribly well. So an interesting question then is how children come to differentiate those two claims, and whether they in some sense think of them as distinct and organized, and ultimately how do children articulate both types of claim in the sense that they might be alert to competition between them, or they might compartmentalize them. And I don't yet have any strong ideas or intuitions about what happens here. But you can see that we're beginning now to think about then the fact that there's a sort of range of different types of testimony, and a problem for children is how to organize it and how to fit it all together. Let me stop there.
Should run presidential candidates
at the very least, you think they ought to be able to differentiate. Yeah.
It made me think about my friend who's a theoretical physicist at MIT, and he spent 10 years taking in the testimony of others, incorporating the testimony of others, about 10 years after. And now MIT is paying him to go back to being sort of a Montessori child, or, you know, experiments on his own. He sits there, stand out the window, and draws little pictures, and in fact, he's returning to the state of the child. And then, if he makes an advance in science, it would be because he's come back to sort of like a state of imagination.
Right. Although I wouldn't, as I said, I mean, part of the burden of my talk is that the state of the child is not the state of the idealized experimentalist setting ultimately all testimony in suspense and seeing what the data truly speak. That's rarely the state of the child, I would say. Yeah.
I was just wondering what the scale is, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Oh. Oh, right. Yeah, they were asked about, I can't remember whether it was 3 or 4 entities now, so it's effectively the proportion of times they say yes. Yeah. The proportion of those entities. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, when you say how do children differentiate from what we actually mean to be back in faith, I wonder how that feeds into your earlier question when you asked me where your mind comes from. Because presumably some children want to both say that God saved the world and that
yes.
We've all been supposed to have that lesson. And in that case, the question is a little bit more fair one. The child is going to answer this.
Yes. So that's a fair point. It's certainly conceivable that when Margaret Evans posed what appeared to be the same question in different communities, it was being construed back to a different mode of discourse. And perhaps in some sense, a prior question then would be to say, essentially, something like, I don't know how to phrase it in a child-friendly way, but one wants to set the context by saying, when scientists talk about dinosaurs, they say various things. Now, and I'm going to ask you the kinds of things they say. So it's conceivable that children growing up in those fundamentalist communities then would, as it were, look much more like the non-fundamentalist children if you pose the question in that kind of a way. Now, having said all that, there's some interesting work going over in William James. Andrew Stuhlman, a graduate student working with Susan Carey, is talking to Harvard undergraduates about their understanding of Darwinian theory and finding that Harvard undergraduates have quite a tough time. So I wouldn't want to press the distinction between, as it were, belief and understanding too hard. I think there are also going to be differences in, quotes, understanding and limitations to understanding that are pretty widespread. Yeah. Kurt?
You're grounding your work in cognitive development and cognitive science more broadly, where it seems to me you're right on target that there hasn't been much effective dealing with testimony. But if you look at something like late Wittgenstein with language communities or discourse communities, or you look at modern cognitive linguistics where they're essentially trying to describe the basic structures behind discourse, do you see them as maybe more consonant?
Yes. Certainly the later Wittgenstein, insofar as I or anyone understands him, I think that's absolutely right. There's a book called On Certainty, which was recommended to me by my philosopher colleague back in Oxford, Peter Hacker, who's something of a Wittgenstein specialist. And I read that and was very taken by it. I mean, it's the kind of thing you read. It's a little bit like brandy. I mean, it's very, very heady stuff. You don't want to drink too much of it at once. But it does ultimately shift your sort of cognitive stance quite a lot, I think, in trying to point out. Well, there's two messages, in some sense. First of all, how little we know in the straightforward empirical sense, and how much we don't know in that sense. But nevertheless, it so much informs our way of life and our way of talking to one another that we're as certain of it as we are of the stuff that we take to be empirical. And particularly, I think some examples have to do with our sense of time, our sense of our fitting into an unrolling temporal structure with ourselves, changing over time and having a history. That's not something that is open to the kind of empirical, having, of course, a family and ancestors and so forth. That's not something that's open to the kind of empirical verification that, what's written on this paper is open to empirical verification. But nevertheless, so Wittgenstein argues, I'm as certain of it as that. And I suppose you're right, I'd never thought of the connection, but in some sense that sort of forms of life argument is also echoed in recent work in cognitive linguistics. You're thinking of people like Faussonnier and
Lakoff.
And Lakoff. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Graph, and I'm not sure I agree with you, Mike, but it was interesting for me going back to the Santa Claus question that more of the kids said they knew what a flying pig looked like than would say that it was real.
Uh-huh.
There was a higher line for
color. Yeah.
So you could, these kids somehow knew that you could describe something, but it could still not be real at the same time.
Yeah. I suppose that's reasonable, isn't it? They in some sense can concoct in their imagination what a flying pig might look like. I guess if I put that task to you, it wouldn't be too taxing. Actually, you can ask children to draw pictures of germs, even though they claim they don't know what they look like. I stumbled across this just as I was getting ready this morning. If I can find the picture. I was going to scan it to show you, but I couldn't find a scanner. So anyway, there's a picture of a germ by a young child, and you can see it's got a couple of teeth and some eyes and some legs, and it's pretty monstrous. So I'm assuming that again the child is saying, you know, let me rely on my imagination, and of course the default is some kind of quasi human like person, but of a slightly monstrous type. Yeah. Yes. 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 No, I think that's absolutely right. So in some sense, this way of thinking about cognitive development makes much more contact with social psychology and social cognition than traditional modes of thinking about cognitive development. And a key word there would be trust. Who do you trust? And who do you think of as an expert? So with Melissa Koenig, who's a postdoc working here with me, we're trying to think about those issues a little bit more as far as the early childhood period is concerned. So one very simple issue is, say a child has a question. Are they selective in who they put that question to? Do they know that for certain questions you probably better go to your parents or adults in your community, but for questions about, I don't know, magic cards, you know, your father is completely ignorant and you better go and speak to your brother. I assume that those kind of differentiations do take place pretty early, and of course alongside that will be some kind of record keeping about who's more trustworthy, reliable than somebody else. But we know next to nothing about it. I mean, we don't know the extent to which children start to make those differentiations in early childhood, but one just intuits that they must do. And then there are other more emotionally charged issues to do with attachment and security and so forth, which may also feed in. Yeah.
The
I see. Yes, I have. So the child as witness, you know, is an interesting issue. Yeah. Right. I see. Yeah, no, I hadn't thought about that. That's an interesting angle. Yeah. Susan.
Have you been thinking or thought about the implications of parents in particular who support these ideas like Santa Claus and such, and at the same time are giving testimony on things that they would like to continue throughout life? And then when children figure out that there isn't a Santa Claus, does it make them think that maybe other things that parents are telling them are also false? We talk about stress.
Yes. That's an interesting question. I mean, certainly some communities, fundamentalist Christian communities, are actually disinclined to tell children about Santa Claus on the grounds that when the child becomes disabused of that belief, that may threaten what the community regards as more important beliefs. I'm not sure about that. I mean, I certainly don't think that children, as it were, turn on their parents and say, you...
One of my kids actually said, what else have you been lying to me?
Oh, right. I mean, you're a special case, Kurt. I mean, I suspect, trust was rapidly restored. But I actually think that, nevertheless, that may be a dramatic illustration for the child of the fact that, okay, it may not be that the child draws any particular conclusions about the person who's misled them, quotes, but it may well be that the child gradually starts drawing conclusions about the extent to which one can be misled, notwithstanding deep faith. Yeah.
I'm curious what you said about
the idea of the right and wrong that the parents and the mental leaders have added to the children. Is that successfully, or is there something else more, much more complicated to the Chilean government, or attitude to it?
Well, of course, there's an interesting claim in recent work on moral development, which I haven't thought of it this way, but in some sense you could say that, contrary to what one might have expected, children are actually more autonomous, quotes, stubborn, autodidacts in the realm of morality than they ultimately are in the realm of cognition, because of all the work by people like Turiel and Smetana suggesting that, you know, pretty early on children are differentiating between matters of arbitrary social convention and, quotes, relatively permanent moral truths, which have to do with forms of life, if you like. You know, it's distressing to hit other people, it's distressing to take their toys, and so forth. So, you could, as I say, this argument just striking me for the first time, but you could argue that that's a very interesting domain where children are indeed stubborn, and quite, in some sense, rightly so. Yeah. I'm not sure about that. I mean, if anything, one would be inclined to think that children perhaps start off being fairly credulous. And if anything, with development, they become more alert to the possibility of doubt and mistrust. Now, there may be certain areas in which we think they don't do that enough, or do it reflectively enough, or not critical enough. But very broadly speaking, I'm assuming that the default position that children start off with is one of trust. And if anything, it's doubt that comes later. Does that?
For example, when you learn the science of that, you don't have any education with this concept.
Yes.
So there's a no doubt, you just learn.
Yes. Yes.
But I think as you become older, there's more trust as to that.
So as we get older, we become less trusting or more critical? So what do you think happens at first? The children just take it on board but don't really trust it?
Because I think that education or student experience, they think it's a piece of fabric that there's a fantasy that it's a case of trust without any doubt, without any verification. But the tangent is more bigger as it is older.
I'm not sure that I'm fully grasping the direction in which you're thinking of the child as moving, because, as I say, my temptation is to think that trust declines, and I'm hearing you say that trust increases.
Early on, though, children often will say, well, when a teacher says the earth is round, you know, but I know better.
Uh-huh.
So, there are things that they're taught as scientific facts that they don't really trust. once that you had a lot of experience with science, maybe some of us anyway, come to be able to
believe. I see.
This relates to something which I'm sure is in your background, the whole Putnam notion of expertise, which we accept as adults because we understand the big areas that we can't know about.
Right.
I think in that sense, I agree with sort of what Kurt, I think kids often will spout what they think the conventional wisdom is, but if it goes against their what they see themselves, they're much less likely to ascribe to experts ways of verifying which they can't do within their expertise.
Yeah, although I guess I would add that as present, we don't have much sense of the extent to which even 4, 5, 6-year-olds are beginning to figure out this notion of expertise. Frank Kyle is starting to do some work on that, and beginning to recognize it, for example, that there are some people who are specialists in biology, some people who are specialists in engineering. And so I suppose once that's on board, then this possibility of, in some sense, mistrusting their own observational database might come in relatively early. And I'm also tempted to say that we still have, as it were, a research problem, in the sense that whilst I agree with you that science education literature identifies these kinds of instances, we still have to ask ourselves, okay, what's the difference between those kinds of instances where the child holds on pretty easily to their, as it were, pre-existing intuitive theory and resists this new information, as compared to the metaphysical concepts, where the child seems to assimilate these metaphysical concepts fairly easily, and notwithstanding the fact they're in flat contradiction to things that the child is assimilating about.
Well, biology may be easier than causal process kinds of.
Well, although the, you know, the God stuff, in some sense, you know, what would God see, under what circumstances would God know, this is already implicating a causal analysis. It's not just ontological.
Yeah, but see, the way I read some of your data differently is I think the kids are retrofitting a lot of this stuff into very simplistic kinds of notions. And I just use myself as an example. I'm one of the least imagistic people I know. I have very few mathematicians of any sort. And I'm quite sure that I had a whole God story, you know, replete with music and everything else, and I think kids have that for lots of things. So even if they may recognize certain ontological distinctions, I think the way to think about these things are very, very simple. And to be able to say, well, somebody has a more, somebody else understands quantum mechanics and I don't, but I'm going to accept that. That's
much more complicated. Yeah. Yes.
In the latter part of your paper, you are not sure only the mean response of children to the population. I'm curious to know the amount of variation in response for children of a particular age group. The reason I'm asking this is that I'm wondering whether, other than age, there are other significant compounding factors, for example, the child's personality or the his or her social upbringing. And by that I mean whether the child has lots of interaction with older kids and adults that they feel a close affinity to or rely on, and therefore the child has more inclination to accept their testimony, versus an introverted child who has lesser interaction with adults, whom they do not necessarily rely on for physical or emotional support.
We haven't looked at those kinds of variables so far. I mean, certainly he may well speculate that, you know, personality differences are going to play a role in the data. We haven't looked at them as yet. This is pretty early days in the research program, and you know, you choose the things you think of as likely to be accounting for a lot of the variants, things like age and social community. And I'd be inclined to think of as personality as something that in due course one would look at, but it's not top of the agenda, so to speak.
Do you see a big variation in the response of kids in the
population? Which study are you talking about now?
I'm referring to the graphs in the latter part. 3, 4, and 5 year
old. If you categorize, say, the 4-year-olds, you'll find that some of them are looking more like 5-year-olds and some of them are looking more like 3-year-olds. So you're getting differences in rates of transition, certainly. But that's consistent, of course, with what we know from all sorts of data in more prosaic domains. I mean, all the false belief data equally says that, you know, the timing of this is roughly between 3 and 5, but there's a range of variation. And of course, people have also begun to explore some of the individual differences, variables, be it short-term memory or capacity for inhibition, that might be impinging on that. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I just want to ask real quickly. Do you think all concepts about metaphysical beings come from testimony, or perhaps young children, just through their imagination, think about monsters and ghosts being able to be under their bed even if they can't see them either?
Yeah. No, I agree. In some sense, I was asked this question earlier about intuitive notions of God. I mean, where the child's imagination is going to be fertile and will supply various principles and possibilities, and some much more readily than others. And to that extent, testimony will fall on, you know, more or less fertile ground. So that's a whole issue in itself. The constraints on the child's imagination and the extent to which the child's imagination lends itself easily to certain types of testimony. And again, to re-mention cognitive anthropology, that's something that they themselves have put on the table as an important issue, because they ask about the fact that certain collective representations, certain testimonies, easily get transmitted from generation to generation, don't get lost, don't get distorted, get preserved, and therefore one's assuming that in some sense there's some readily available slots for them to fit into and get passed on to the next generation.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.